Good afternoon. Joining us on the line now is BAFTA-winning comedy writer Joel Morris, a longtime collaborator with Charlie Brooker and the co-creator of dimwit pundit Philomena Kunk. He has written for countless TV and radio shows, including Mitchell and Webb, Miranda and Murder in Successville, as well as the Paddington films. He's also one of the authors of the chart-busting Ladybird books for grown-ups. His new book, Be Funny or Die, looks at how comedy works and why it matters. Welcome to the show, Joel.
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm all right, yes. Very
good.
Jolly.
Oh, it's lovely to have you with us. I'm interested to know how you got into comedy writing. How does that happen?
I mean, it's very, very similar to music, I think. You sort of listen to a lot of it as a kid and then think, I'd like to give that a go. I got into it. I started doing it when I was at school, when I was like a little kid. I decided if I made comics and sold them in the playground, I could get money for sweets. And that's how I started. And sort of haven't really changed much since I was seven. So yeah, yeah. It's the same thing. It's the same. It's the old story that people say about you do it to make friends. Or to stop people punching you. It's the class clown thing. But yeah, I did that as a kid. I then just kept going and thought, I wonder if you can turn this into a job. And here we are many, many years later.
Yeah.
Still doing the same thing.
And how does it feel for you when you're writing the comedy, but then other people are performing it? Obviously, you've, I guess, chosen to do that. But what's that like? Kind of not always necessarily getting the credit and recognition for being the funny one.
Actually, it's not bad. I mean, I'm not a performer, and I grew up very, very conscious there were people who were very funny who weren't performers, whether it was like Douglas Adams or P.G. Woodhouse or people like David Nobbs, who wrote the Reggie Perrin series. There seemed to be a lot of Gorton and Simpson. There were lots of writers who were just the writers of things. And I thought, that sounds fun. And a bit similar to sort of making comics and things. And then obviously that's as a job, there's fewer and fewer people who do that. So I like it, and I'm not a performer. So I quite like the fact that someone who's much better than me goes out there and fronts it. One of the loveliest things you can do is be in a room where you're working with writer performers and you throw a joke in and it bounces off the other performers. I work with the guys who do Horrible Histories and Ghosts a few times, and you throw a joke in, or Mitchell and Webb, and the joke bounces off them and it's performed back at you, and suddenly the characters come to life. I mean, that's really magical. That's like, I don't know, writing music for someone who's an astonishing guitarist to suddenly play it back.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a funny thing to write a joke and then not hear any laughter for 6 months. That's a very strange feeling.
Yes, I can imagine. And tell me about the work that you've done with Charlie Brooker, because he's great, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, I've known Charlie for ages. I've met Charlie when, again, writing on magazines and things. He comes from that background. He's very much a writer. Again, he ended up doing stuff where he was performing on screen, but it's not really his natural thing. He's definitely a writer. We sort of got on really well, very, very similar sense of humour, very similar backgrounds. And Charlie needed people who could write in his voice. And he tried lots of different people. And that's one of the skills of the job is, can you write? It's like being a journalist. Can you write in the house style of a magazine or a newspaper? And found it very, very easy to write in Charlie's voice, similar age, similar background, similar tastes, similar things make us laugh. So, it's always been an absolute joy writing with Charlie. He's always been very generous with credit and with work. And it's just brilliant fun. When you get a chance to play with him, it's one of the most fun toy sets to be playing with.
Yeah. And tell us about the Ladybird books for grown-ups, because there's so many now in that series, but some brilliant, brilliant, funny titles and books. That must have been great fun to put together.
Yeah, and that was just, I mean, I often say that my favourite books are funny books. If I ever go into a secondhand bookshop, I go and look at the humour section first, which is one of the reasons I've written a book about humour and a humour book. I thought that the chance to sort of come up with something which then sort of sold that many copies, to sort of stand up for the fact that I think humour books are lovely, whether it's, I don't know, a Far Side annual or a Viz book or a great comic novel. But I've always wanted to write great comic books. And that was, I came up with that with my writing partner, Jason. And we suddenly found this format, these beautiful illustrations that everyone was very, very fond of. And that you could just tweak them slightly and talk about the modern world through these vintage illustrations was just such a great place to find a joke. And then people just love lap them up. And again, being a writer, you don't get a chance to get that laugh very often. And the great thing about those is you could wander into a bookshop, hide, and watch people picking them up and giggling. And it felt like being a stand-up. Your joke was getting a laugh.
Oh, nice. Brilliant. So what was the kind of inspiration behind this book then, Be Funny or Die? What were you wanting to say and look at with this?
Well, I think, I mean, A, comedy is important, I think. It's, as I often say, it's one of the two masks that's on the front of the theatre. There's drama and comedy. And there's been an awful lot of drama being made. It's the golden age of television drama. And you've just had the Oscars. The dramas tend to be the ones that win. And I think comedy, that's the other one, isn't it? I mean, Shakespeare wrote both of them. And it's a bit of a, sometimes it seems a bit naughty or a bit silly or not as clever. But if you talk to any actor, they always say that comedy is harder than doing drama. So they know what they're talking about. So this was a sort of defense of comedy as a great thing. And also, I was desperate to find out how it worked, because I've been using it the whole of my life and earning a living from it. And I had some sort of gut feelings that there were some tricks, that it might be a bit like stage magic. There's like 7 tricks you're doing, and a bit like music. There's only 12 notes. And people talk about those as crafts, and they talk about them very, very openly without spoiling the magic. You can talk about how, you know, that the magician's really got it up his sleeve, but people don't want to talk about comedy that way. And I thought the strange thing was, I looked for a book that said, hang on, here are the 3 chords that make up every comic's song. Every joke is made of these notes. There must be a way of explaining it. And by sort of drilling down into it, talking to some scientists, talking to a lot of comedians, having a lot of long walks and lots of cups of tea, came up with what was basically a play in a day chord book for comedy that explains it in the simple building blocks that I think most people can understand, but you don't realize that's what's going on.
No.
And if you shine a light on it, actually what's going on is both very, very simple and enormously clever.
Mm. But has that format changed over the years, or are you saying that the basis is the same? Because it seems to me now comedy is, well, with the whole woke brigade, people have to be more and more careful with the kind of comedy they're putting out there, because people are getting more and more offended. And it's, I really feel for comedians and writers having to, you know, worry about what they're saying. Do you notice that?
I think, I mean, this is something that I was really interested in writing about in the book. And I think, I mean, I hope I've made a good case for it. I think that's always happened. And what it is that one of the great things that comedy does is it draws us together. We all gather together. It's like gathering around a fire. And scientists say it's in evolution of us picking nits off each other as sort of like apes when we were much, much younger, or much, much millions of years ago. And it's basically, we're doing it to make ourselves feel better. And so one of the important things about comedy is it's social. It gathers us together and we all go, oh, good, we'll all laugh at the same thing. And all that's going on there is the audience is changing. Or the audience is getting too broad, as in one of the hard things to do now is you make a joke that you might have made for 2 or 3 friends and suddenly it's broadcast all over the world and the wrong people hear it, or someone who maybe doesn't find it as funny as you do hears it. The problem is not to do with the joke. The joke is the same joke as it would have been hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago. Jokes are just jokes. The audiences have changed. They've become more complicated. They've become more broadly disseminated. And all it means is that as someone who works in comedy, you've got to be more careful, more clever, and also you've got to know your audience. And also, if you decide you don't want to, if you want to make a joke that offends people, then just do that. Mm-hmm. I think that's the trick with this, is to realize that all you're ever doing with a joke is making other people, the audience, your friends, happy. And so all you're trying to do is make them laugh. If you've misjudged the audience, that's something you could do. Anyone who's ever tried to be a stand-up or tell a wedding speech or make a joke at work has misjudged an audience. And you know that feeling, your stomach falls out. You've misread the room. I think all of that big fuss that's going on about woke is about reading or misreading the room, which is a really fundamental tool in comedy. I write about it in the book. It's something I think everyone, Ken Dodd knew how to read the room. Les Dawson knew how to read a room. Everyone's always used that skill. What's interesting now is people go, well, I misread the room and now something's gone wrong. And you went, I think that's the same as it would have been in ancient Rome. Sometimes you can misread the room and someone goes, I don't find that funny, and stands up. I think there's just more people ready to stand up or walk out than they used to be.
And obviously you'll always get comedians who don't care about reading the room, who don't care about offending people. And, you know, this is their humour. And if people don't like it, that's their problem, kind of thing. You know, Frankie Boyle springs to mind, you know.
I think what he's doing is he's reading the room. He's playing to an audience who want him to make those jokes. And whether you're deliberate of Jerry Sandovitz or something, you're playing to these things. I don't think, one of the things I say in the book is I don't think anyone laughs when they don't feel safe. Even a nervous laugh is trying to encourage you to, oh, come on, we can all do this together. There's a lovely thing, the thing that's amazing about comedy and why it's so soothing and so welcome and why we need more of it is it makes us feel safe, and it makes us feel safe by bonding us together. We all agree with the values in a joke. We agree that we find this comedian funny or our favourite sitcoms funny, or we recognise those characters. It's a way of saying who we are. And a comedian who sort of is trying to sort of be a bit naughty and maybe offend an audience is actually saying to the rest of their audience, we're in a gang. We all get this joke. We're all together. Comedians are always bonding their audience together to make them laugh about shared values. What they might do is eject some other people from that gang who didn't get the joke. And then all you're saying then is, you're on my team or not on my team. It's what jokes do, even in the playground. We all remember doing that as kids. You sort of, who's in the gang, who's not in the gang. And I think comedy is one of the tools we use to do that, to gather people around us and to make ourselves feel good and safe.
Yeah. So do you think comedy has evolved then? Do you think it has changed compared to what it was 20, 40 years ago?
I don't think so, because I'm a big fan of comedy and I can find joy in very, very old stuff. I grew up on sort of old LPs of stuff from way back. My dad was a big music hall fan. I don't see that the structure has changed. That's, I think, is what the book's about. I think the underlying jokes are still the underlying jokes. And if you think about it like music, what you're talking about here is that the 12 notes in the scale are still the same. The piano keyboard is still the same, but you're singing different songs at the top of it. The lyrics have changed. And the joy, I think, of comedy is that if you know those three chords that you can vamp out a song at a party and make your friends happy, you can sing anything you like over the top. And I think that's what changes, is that sometimes the music stays the same and the song changes. The same notes are in Beethoven as are in the Arctic Monkeys. That's what I'm saying in the book, is that comedy and the way it delights us and brings humans together or drives humans apart or makes us happy or think or whatever hasn't changed. But I think what the songs people are singing have changed over time. And the great thing about that is you can choose to sing whatever you want to that melody, because the melody is still catchy. And it's the same as, it's the same tune that nursery rhymes are done to. That nice, basic, simple melodies will always delight us, yeah. Whether it's Ken Dodd or Frankie Boyle. They're the same tunes, really.
Thoughts on canned laughter?
Canned laughter. Actually, the great thing about canned laughter is people think it's there. And it sort of isn't. It hasn't been used for ages. People hear it all the time. What they're talking about very often is they don't like to hear the sound of an audience enjoying themselves because you feel lonely. You go, what are these idiots laughing at? Canned laughter as a recorded trigger is used on old cartoons. It's on Scooby-Doo and things. But if you see a live show, if you see Mrs. Brown's Boys, that's a real audience that's really laughing. And one of the reasons that that's on there is because humans are social animals. We laugh together. And most of the laughter that's triggered in your life is not even caused by jokes. It's just the sound of people getting along. You'll sort of laugh when you're with a friend. You'll laugh. So 80%, I think, of laughter is not even triggered by jokes. It's just the sound of people being at home in a room. And I think when people hear what they think of as canned laughter on a show and go, I don't like that, they don't like being told to be part of a gang. Particularly now that we watch a lot of television on our own, on headphones, on little screens, we're not necessarily in a group anymore. So I think we've evolved slightly in that area, in that we've moved to watching comedy alone. But it's not traditionally what comedy was meant for. It's meant to be a room full of people laughing, and you laugh much more easily when you're with other people than you would do solo.
Yeah, well, they do laughter therapy, don't they? It's actually a thing, getting people together and following other people laughing.
It's very good. It's that Robin Williams film, wasn't it? About the guy who sort of did therapy through sort of clown performances.
Oh, yeah,
it feels
yeah.
really good to laugh. And I think one of the reasons that I wrote the book as a defense of comedy, there have been a lot of studies recently about how much comedy is being produced on television and radio, and it's way less than they used to be, which is another reason that people get so upset about it, is they're not making enough of it. If they were making more, it would be much broader and more people would be happy. We need comedy. if you sort of said if it was comedy versus drama or comedy versus news, what should you put the money into?
Comedy.
Exactly. You wander into the foyer of any big broadcasting organisation, the first thing you see usually is a big picture of one of their hit comedies, whether it's Eric and Ernie at the BBC. It's not usually a big picture of a news presenter or a big picture of some really tense drama. And I think it's really, really bad for us as a species to be always tense, which is what drama does. It might be quite nice to have something where you go, oh, it's those guys again. Look, it's the guys from Dad's Army. They're back. Oh, I know what they're going to do. That familiarity, that comfort is like running into old friends. And I think that the great thing about a comedian whose sense of humour you agree with, or a sitcom where you know all the characters, is that you drop in with them and you go, ah, good, those guys. It's the same as going down the pub with people you really, really know.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. And I mean, it all sounds kind of obvious, doesn't it? But, you know, I mean, I love a good drama as well, don't get me wrong. But
we need both.
Yeah. But you know, there will be people who, you know, religiously watch the news at various points of the day, or listen to the news, wherever they get it from. And then, you know, they'll be watching gripping dramas in the evening and talking about that. And if that's kind of all they're doing, then, as you say, their life and their brains are kind of on edge and worrying about all the true stuff that's actually happening in the world connected to the news, and then the fictional worry of the other programs that they're watching. But we all know when we watch a good comedy, or whether it's someone doing stand-up or just a fun panel show or a comedy TV film, whatever it is, it makes us laugh, it makes us happy, and that's just a completely different feeling to watching the news.
Exactly. I think what it is a friend of mine, a comedian friend of mine, recently described it as a balanced diet. There's lots and lots of good broccoli in comedy. It works your brain. One of the great things about comedy, it works your brain quite fast. It's lots of really little quick things. Drama is sometimes quite slow and tense, or the news is quite, so it winds you up. Comedy, you'll get a laugh every three or four lines, and that works. You can work the little puzzle out and get to the end of the joke, and you get a little uplift, a little dopamine hit. You'll feel really good. It's a balanced diet. And I think especially we've just been through an absolutely terrible bunch of years where everyone was very tense. And the first thing people turn to when you ask people, what are you watching? The number of people who said, I'm watching this panel show, the whole family's got together, we're watching this sitcom, we're all watching Ghosts, or we're all watching Taskmaster, or we're watching whatever the show was you picked as a family. And they did that because we were all really tense. Mm-hmm. And the great thing is you need that break and to offer that. And comedy is very, very personal. As you just said, what someone laughs at, someone else finds offensive, or someone disagrees with. So you need as much comedy as possible so you can find your thing. It's like supporting a sports team. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work. I used to say it's a bit like any town that's only got one pub in it. You need three or four pubs because you have to find your pub. You need to have your thing that you like. People have got very specific tastes in comedy. So the more of it that's made, the more people can go and find stuff. I'm a big defender of it. It's kind of the secret message behind the book, is that this is a really valuable, very, very complicated and clever skill. And we should be making as much of it as possible because it makes people happy.
Definitely. Well, go make more, Joel. Get on with it.
Well, yes, I should run off. I've got a script on the screen now. I should be finishing that.
Brilliant. Stop talking to me, then off you pop.
Work to do.
Exactly. Oh, no, it's brilliant. Good for you. It's great to have you with us on the show. If people want to get a copy of the book, it's called Be Funny or Die, How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Joel Morris, who we've been chatting with today. Joel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for the chance.